Mr. Barnett, Rio 4. Now, we were talking when you'd rejoined the 16th Battalion, basically between May and September of 43, before you went off to Salerno, the Salerno things. Do you have any memories of what exactly you were doing, the training? It sounds as if you weren't doing a lot.
We were. It's strange. I don't remember a lot of military maneuvers, certainly not. We must have been doing military training of that kind. I can remember odd things, like, for example, tea. Now, tea was an absolute vital nectar during that period, because it was obviously during the hottest part of the summer. We were at Bleda, which was just a dusty plain with no shade of any trees whatsoever, under Campbell. And the mountains were quite close. We were right at the foot of them. So tea became essential. And we used to, for example, go into the big marquee for to eat, where all the officers sat at the table at tea time. And the long table, the centre of which was covered with a mosquito net to keep the flies off the buns and cakes and things. And we used to go in and wrap a handkerchief or a neckerchief round our necks, because we knew we were going to perspire drinking hot tea in as large quantities as we could manage. And there we sat, perspiring and dribbling into our neckerchiefs, and eating our buns, snatching our buns from under the net, and eating before the flies got on. And then we used to go up into the mountain with our platoons to exercise in, because we didn't do it, but we were training for mountain warfare, to exercise our chaps on moving about on mountains and keeping them fit. And one man was always detailed to carry a large tin, and another one had tins of condensed milk, and somebody else had as much tea as if we could count from the cooks. Because up in the mountains there was a marvellous supply of spring clear water, wonderful it was, which was put into irrigation channels on little plateaus of land by the Arabs, of course, for growing market garden stuff. But there was always plenty of water, and so that we used to have frequent stops working out before we went off how many brews we could make during the day. And make frequent stops, just have a making frequent stops for making tea, which was done by putting the can, a big tin, on the ground, filling it with water from the water bottles, which we'd filled at the springs. Everyone put his water bottle in, and then building a fire around it, because there were plenty of trees there, particularly cork oaks, the kind of stunted oaks which they make cork from the bark. And then in the middle of this bonfire was a huge can of water which boiled in about 3 minutes. Throw in the tea, throw in the condensed milk, throw in the pounds of sugar, and sit down with our mugs and enjoy this tea. That used to be really a great treat. And of course, up in the mountains too, there's very often big trees and one or two things that seem to grow more or less wild, which we hate. So they're happy memories of the of course.
What do you remember of that? I mean, you went into the mountains. What were you, besides the actual physical training of getting up there, what else were you doing towards mountain warfare?
Not a lot. I can't recall any, for example, any use of live ammunition whatsoever. Whether we did or not, I don't know, but I certainly can't recall any. We just used to do movements on the mountains, which were an excuse for mountaineering, I think. Ronnie and I once went off on our own, I remember, for the day, because Ronnie had been on a mountain climbing course. And we did a bit of rope work on abseiling down escarpments and things, and we went up. Oh, and once we were going, we were out with the men in the pass that ran through to Zahara, and we found a German prisoner who had escaped from a French, or I suppose a French prisoner of war camp, and hadn't had a very happy time with them, and we were very happy to see British troops, and of course the men were dealing with cigarettes, tea and biscuits at home. We kept him in the camp for a bit, but we had to give him back in the end. But it was a happy time. I remember, too, this dreadful thirst we continuously had. And I think we had some beer, but I'm not sure whether we got an issue of beer or not. However, soft drinks, the only glasses we had were sawn-off bottles, which tend to be rather small, less than a reasonable tumbler. And what we had a perpetual desire for was a pint glass. And I was once travelling by road somewhere and called at a little French, French bar for a beer. And you could get, of course, then that's right, you could get French beer and lemonade, bit of lemonade, and I thought the mixture would be thirst quenching. And up on the wall, I'll forget it, on the little shelf was an advertisement for Phoenix beer. And it was a little shelf with a big glass on the big tumbler. It must have been at least a pint in size. And I asked the barman if I can have the glass off that little shelf, so he gave it to me, and I filled it up with beer and lemonade and had one of the biggest and happiest drinks of the war there in that little bar.
How did you get on with the Algerian and French, you know, French civilians that were about?
Well, quite well, the Arabs too. There were mostly Arabs there. They seemed to be perfectly friendly, and we bought eggs from them, and relationship. Of course, I suppose they would be fairly friendly because, of course, we were all soldiers and armed and in occupation. It was, I suppose, we were, well, not feared because nothing to fear, but respected because of that, I suppose. But there was never, I knew of
any. There was never any trouble?
No trouble. And,
did the battalion behave well? I mean, did some of the men. When they got it,
there must have been some instance of drunkenness or something, but not that I ever heard of British troops anywhere, but about to cause some trouble, I suppose. But no, I really was never personally involved in any at all, even drunkenness. I don't think there was a lot of drink available. There was some sweet wine there, you know, but and this light beer, but no.
How did you feel about, the approach of action? Because it must have been obvious that towards the end of the period that something was coming up.
Well, we were all, my friends, of course, and I hadn't seen action by that time, of any near to it, but not seen it, really. And so there was apprehension, of course, dread in really, I suppose, is a better word, even in the ignorance of it. But after having experienced the dread, is really fearful. It is really horrific, the prospect of going into action.
How did you get through it? I mean, what?
Well, I think you get through it mainly by being too ashamed to show that you couldn't get through it, really. I think that's the only thing that holds you together. You dare not, for your own self-respect, give way to the fear. But undoubtedly, it's a ridiculous experience to have to face. I mean, all your proper instincts tell you to walk away and go home. But of course you can't. It's a difficult memory. I think it's difficult now for even me and certainly other people to put ourselves into the frame of mind that we young men had at that time. We've been brought up between the two wars with knowledge of war really in a sort of boys on paper context of bravery and heroism and leadership, and you don't send a man where you don't go yourself kind of attitude. And for a while, that's the only sort of moral code you use, in a way, that it's not bravery, it's just doing what you're expected to do in those circumstances.
How did that coincide with the sort of knowledge of Third Ypres, Passchendaele, the Somme, you know, the slaughter on the Western Front? Or did you just blot your mind out to that? How did you get through it?
That's something that nobody in civilian life can really understand. It's got to be experienced to really know what it's about. It's fairly easily forgotten as well. It can be forgotten.
So the horrors of the First World War weren't particularly known to you?
No.
And the boy's own element had it once again come to the fore.
Yes, that's right. Yes.
How about the men that they'd been in action? How did they feel about it? Or were you aware of how they felt?
No. They never talked about it. Those that had been. You don't even know much. It is odd. And hard to understand or explain.
What was the first news you had of, well, it was to be the Italian campaign? I mean, how were you briefed?
Well, of course, we didn't, at our level, we weren't included in the plans for where the landing was to be or anything. I don't know down to what level that information came. Certainly not to our level. I don't know whether it came down to battalion commanders or not. It obviously had to be a deep secret as far as possible. We obviously knew that the next step would be on the attack on the mainland, because I think, if I remember rightly, the invasion of Sicily started in July. It was certainly previous to the attack on the mainland. So we didn't know really whether we'd be going to Sicily or somewhere else. I do have recollections of war rooms, and I can't remember where they were, which were, rooms where meetings were held and plans were made and where a lot of maps were displayed. But I really can't recall whether that was perhaps at Bizerta before we left or not, and how much instruction we had, if any at all. But as far as practicalities were concerned, we were moved to Bizerta from Lida about a couple of weeks, I suppose. That must have been towards the end of August, before departure from Bizerta. And at Bizerta, we were just again in tented accommodation in the olive groves behind the town. We were air raided every night. It used to rain shrapnel, and we slept under lorries or, you know, it was only shrapnel really that we were defending ourselves from. Just waiting, we met the crews of the landing ships, which were all American as far as we were concerned. We were going to be moved on a LSI, which is a landing ship infantry, which takes, I think, takes four platoons, took more than a company.
Did you have any sort of landing practice or...
Yes, we used to have landing practice on the beaches, getting on and off the ships. And the...
At Bizerta, or earlier?
Yes, around Bizerta. And the fear was that we would be landed on a sandbar beyond which there was deeper water before you got onto the shore, because it's quite a hazard if you've got to cross deep water in a full kit. They're rather heavy. So there was a kind of competition between the American crews to pride themselves on not dropping troops too far off the shore on a bar, because of course they were very vulnerable targets while they were grounded, and wanted to get off with their kedge anchors as soon as they could get the troops off. So the idea was to land, get the troops off and get away. And the American crews were very keen to let you know that they weren't going to drop you in the drink, as you might say. And we had them in the camp. The crew of the ship we'd been allocated to. Just the officers we had, there were about three or four of them. And we had them into the mess, which was just, of course, a small tent, to a party before we left, because we had to drink up the floating ration of whiskey and beer that we couldn't take with us. Rather drunken brawl, and we had to take the
brawl or party.
Party, not a brawl, not a party. And we played drink games, you know, and then took these, and of course we're all easily inebriated.
What sort of drink games were they playing then?
Well, Garden of Puff was a popular one. Did you know what Garden of Puff is? I don't know. I can remember now. I haven't played it since. You have to say a funny rhyme, you see. I drink to the health of Cardinal Puff. What is it? And, oh, that's right. The initiator of the game demonstrates to the newcomers this little rhyming poem, you see, and then you drink, empty your glass at the end of it. And if you get it wrong, you have to empty your glass. And you at the same time as you're saying Cardinal Puff, you have to tap on your, on the table with two fingers. I drink to the health of Cardinal Puff, and you tap on the table with one finger, you see. And then I drink to the health of Cardinal Puff, Puff, and you have to tap on the table twice, but you put two fingers up as well, you see. So it's the first time round, they're bound to forget something, and they do, and they have to drink their glass and start again. So eventually both these poor chaps fell off their forms. They were sitting on dead drunk, of course, and we took them back to the quay where their ship was moored, and it had gone off. So we laid them on the quay, stretched out drunk as lords, with no ship. And anyway, that was just a bit of fun, I suppose. I remember there the notable thing in that camp was the crickets. I'd taken a few books with me when I went, and one of them, which I've lost since to my regret, was a penguin called The Social Life of the Insect World by Faber. And it was illustrated with some photographs. It was about, he was a Frenchman, of course, and it was about insects in the Mediterranean. And in this camp in August, the crickets, which were those cicadas in French, little short, fat crickets, were making the most incredible noise at night, it was really loud, all over the place, this overwhelming noise of the crickets. I remember that. Even when the airways were going, they were making the...
So after this slightly drunken party to get rid of the last of you alcohol, what happened then? You went aboard?
Then we embarked, I think the following day, but a day or two later. and we marched in companies down into Bizerta in a, you know, the order of companies, and then rocked on the ships, leaving all our Bichon kit behind, of course.
What would you take with you then into action as an officer?
Well, we'd take our small packs. We were dressed in khaki drill, the summer uniforms, with long trousers, not shorts, because there was a great deal of casualties from malaria, of course. And we actually had KD small packs which contained mess tins. We were dressed exactly as the men, which contained mess tins, the small kit, which is, I think we'd take a pair of pumps and a gas cape. No gas mask, we never wore gas cape, we took gas masks in each direction. I carried two ammunition pouches here, the front, so I actually wore on the breast. One with, which were the sections or the platoon store of magazines for the Bren guns. Everybody carried Bren gun ammunition. And the other pouch contained a pair of binoculars, I think, a 50 tin of cigarettes. Well, I didn't carry it. I carried magazines for the Browning, for the Tommy gun that I carried. I was the only one in the platoon with a sub-automatic weapon.
When had that been issued? Roughly.
I think it must have been before, while we're at Desert, or not much. I don't think I had that while we're at Bleeder.
And had you had a chance to fire it or learn to fire it?
No, I don't think so.
So there
you go. I can't remember ever practicing with it, no. I think we did perhaps have a shot with it, but only very minor. We didn't seem to have a lot of practice ammunition.
You weren't trained in it then, properly?
No, and I'd never practiced with a pistol.
Or not fired it at all?
Don't think so, no.
So
pistol ammunition was very short. I think we had 12 rounds, and that was about all you'd ever get. Anyway, not that there were any use anyway, but...
So that's what you had with you when you went aboard?
And of course, the platoon would have a 2-inch mortar. And, of course, Brens, three Brens, and every man with his rifle. They carried bayonets, of course, as well. And we had... beekeeper's net, so to put over our helmets, believe it or not, to keep the mosquitoes off our faces, and cotton gauntlet gloves. Now, they expected us to go into action in the evening and put on beekeeper's mosquito nets and gauntlet gloves. Unbelievable. Nobody ever did.
Were they jettisoned early, or...?
Oh, I think so. I never put mine on. I didn't see anybody else put his on. I didn't know what happened to mine. I have no idea whether I kept them or dropped them. I kept the net for squeezing grapes. Straining juice out of it. Anyway. And we embarked on this LSI. And sailed. I think it took us... about 48 hours to get to Sicily, and it was a rough crossing, everybody was sick. And we...
What were conditions like aboard the LSI then? Were you cramped?
It was pretty tight, yes, it was very basic, you know, just the men just on shelves in a big, one big mess place, 120. We had a cabin, I think, where we didn't sleep with the man. We slept in a smaller cabin somewhere. It was pretty crowded. The food was quite good. The Americans cooked the food for us. They had bacon and molasses, I remember, you know, and those little pancakes we had for breakfast. And then we stopped off Sicily for about a day to recover from the seasickness. And we swam off, we just anchored, or did, well, we didn't anchor, it was too deep water, too deep to anchor. We stayed offshore, stopped, a mile or two from the shore, we swam off the ship for a change, and then went off again to Italy. And of course, it was during the night of the 8th of September, I suppose that was, that we heard the news. The ship got it on the radio, of course, that the Italians had given in. And of course, there was loud cheering, really, because we thought that would have to make the landing easy. But it didn't. And we arrived off Salerno in the dark, and our ship discharged. It must have been, it was just getting light when we went off. The engineers were already on the beach, but they hadn't cleared the mines, and I think it was D Company's Sergeant Major who was on the same ship, stepped on the mine, I think, as soon as and was injured.
How did you get off the ship? Did they have?
They had a ramp. It was a pointed bow at the front of the ship with a ramp like a gangplank that came down on either side of the bow. So there were two exits either side of the sharp bow of the ship.
And what did you run out? How deep was the water you went
into? We were.
So you were right in?
They did us proud, yes.
And were you under any fire when you landed?
There was a bit, but not much. The beach wasn't occupied by the enemy then. And there was shell fire, of course, going both ways. We had either a cruiser or a monitor boat, I think, in the bay. We were at the extreme range of fighter cover. I think a Spit could only spend about 20 minutes over the battlefield. But by that time, really, we had air supremacy. We weren't much bothered by aircraft, if at all. We were in North Africa, oddly enough. I remember there. That's something I've forgotten. We used to ride on the trucks with always somebody between the cab and the canvas bit of the truck watching for aircraft, and they used to bang on the top of the cab if he saw aircraft coming, and the truck would grind to a burning halt, and everybody would empty out and run into the ditch at either side of the road. But we weren't bothered by aircraft, that to my knowledge, in Salerno. It was all artillery fire and mortar fire that was dropping.
So what, in the first moment, you got ashore?
We got ashore.
And what could you see? what state was the beach in at that time?
Well, nothing. We didn't see, even look at it, because we ran right across it and into cover. And I think there was some long-range machine gun fire hitting the beach. We didn't wait to see. We got across without any casualties, except this one Sergeant Major. And we avoided that minefield, by the way, after he was hit, by going along the beach a bit in the sea and then coming out lower down. I think the boat had landed a bit longer. Anyway, we then spent the night with an olive grove at the back of the beach. not dug in.
That's the rest of the morning.
Yes, the rest of the day and then into the night.
So you weren't actually given a job to do following landing?
No, there was nothing particular happening there.
Did you have a reserve role then?
No. We didn't know what was happening, and I still don't know, of course, except that we were waiting for orders to move forward, presumably. And I can't remember when we did. We didn't then move forward. Very quickly, we went right through the town of Salerno, just in the usual formation of sections, you know, either side of the road, not fighting at all, and took up positions on this hill behind the town.
Do you know what it was called?
No, it'll be in the book.
We can look it up later.
Yes. I can't remember its name offhand. There was this peculiar seminary on it, which was a Roman Catholic home for mentally retarded people. And this was the curious place that was in the middle of the battle and had both Germans visiting it for water and our own cooks at times, apparently. I didn't know all this until afterwards. And the priest in charge was trying to keep his buildings and his people from being involved in the battle, and he was trying to keep it as a peaceful island, as it were. So he was trying to keep involved with both sides, and it was honoured, oddly enough, by both sides. It wasn't it. But it was between us at that time.
How far away were the German positions from you when you took on from... Because you were on this hill. How far away were...
Well, as far as infantry were concerned, we made no contact for the first few days. We were just... It was longer range than infantry weapons. It was German mortars and artillery. And obviously English, British artillery.
Did you dig in then?
Yes, we dug in because we were mortared continuously for a week.
And how exactly did you go about digging in? What pattern of defences did you dig?
I never actually dug a hole during the whole battle. There was always one there. Both the enemy and us were digging holes, obviously, and you could always find a hole. No doubt some would dug. But I never saw actually a whole dug. During those first few days, we were slowly moving our way up this hill. It was a valley below P, and it finished off with a kind of plateau about the size which might have been. Not a plateau, but a sort of saddle, and then a sharp pimple at the end of the saddle, which was finished at quite a small area of rock, which made a very good OP over into the valley on the other side. That was the value of the position we were holding. And we started off of the first position I can remember on the hill. It was just on the upper side of the seminary wall, which was a wall presumably of stone just behind us, about 6 feet high, I suppose, quite a high wall. Because I remember seeing a big shell. We were looking uphill, you see, the wall was behind us, and when we faced the wall, we were looking up a steep slope. And I remember seeing a shell, and you could see shells sometimes, from big guns, they used to travel slowly, coming towards us and bouncing down this stuff. We could hear it and see it coming. And I just hoped it was going to clear the wall behind us before it went off, which it did, fortunately, burst somewhere behind it. So that was the sort of funny position we were in there. I remember Colonel Preston coming and standing on the edge of my hole and looking down at me, you know, with his fork stick, as you know, his thumb stick, having a chat. And I thought, I wish you hadn't come, you know, making our position as officers all the time standing in front of us.
The mortar fire, was that continuous? Or?
Yes, all the time. And
that was coming from the other side of the hill, was it?
Yeah,
the Germans weren't on the top of the hill.
Oh, no. Well, I think they were then. Yes, I think they were up there. But we didn't know.
And what was the mortar fire like?
Awful. Really terrifying, because it was all the time. The mortars, we knew, the bombs, broke into very small fragments. And they were coming straight down, more or less, and we could hear them start off, because they used to be fired by electrically from 6-barrel mortars. We used to call them Wurlitzers, because they had a notice that the barrels fired in rotation. And then you knew you had about 20 seconds before the bombs arrived. Terrifying it was. And you used to lie at the bottom of the cell looking at a beetle or something in the bottom, you know, wishing you were somewhere else. And shells as well, bigger stuff.
Were you taking casualties as a unit?
Yes, we were, but my platoon was doing very well. It didn't have many, and there were the stretcher bearers put them back, you know, but there were very few on those first few days.